Good morning, friends. It is so good to see you all here this morning. My name is Marshall McKnight, a member of the Adult Education Committee. On behalf of Adult Education and Nassau Church, welcome. It is great to see you, and we're so glad you have joined us on this gorgeous morning. Today we begin a new three-week series titled The Presbyterian Church USA, Past, Present, and Future, that will look at the PCUSA with a lens beyond Nassau Church. And Nassau Church, of course, is a member of the PCUSA denomination. Dr. Heath Carter returns to adult education to lead us off with a look back at some of the history of the PCUSA and the significant occasions that shaped our national congregation. I will introduce Dr. Carter in a moment, but first, let's pray. Please pray with me. Gracious God, we feel so blessed to gather with you on this spring April morning. We give thanks for Dr. Heath Carter and the work he has done for us to make our faith history relevant in our world today. We ask that you continue to bless us with your presence this morning as we explore our past together. May we find your calling for us here today, as our many saints have done in decades and centuries past. In Christ's name we pray, amen. We are so happy and grateful to have Dr. Heath Carter return to adult education. His presentations are always powerfully relevant. Dr. Heath W. Carter is an associate professor of American Christianity at Princeton Theological Seminary, where he teaches and writes about the intersection of Christianity and American public life. He earned a BA in English and theology from Georgetown University in 2003 and an MA from the University of Chicago Divinity School in 2005 and a PhD in history from the University of Notre Dame in 2012. He came to Princeton from Valparaiso University, where he was on faculty from 2012 to 2019. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Carter.
Can you all hear me? Okay, great. Good morning. We have a mighty task ahead of us this morning, which is also somewhat of a hilarious one, which is the spirit. I've been teasing about giving quizzes, but it's really more the spirit of this diagram is so you can understand the complexity that I'm going to attempt to reduce to a simple story that can be told in 35 minutes this morning. The truth is, we have a course at Princeton Seminary where we spend a whole semester on this story. So this is not quite one class session in that course in terms of its length, but we're going to do the best we can and have fun along the way. If there are things that interest you about this, you know, let me know. Maybe we can do more adult ed stuff about that piece, and I'll leave time for Q&A as well. How we got here, the history of the PCUSA in 35 minutes or less. What to say? You know, the PCUSA is a denomination that has long involved a lot of different kinds of folks. It has been a denomination that's been quite culturally significant, and arguably a denomination that's had outsized cultural significance. So I just threw up here some of the kinds of folks that have been Presbyterian along the way. And PCUSA, you know, is one incarnation of Presbyterianism. You can follow all the different incarnations on your map. Fred Rogers, obviously we all know Mr. Rogers. Ida Wells Barnett, who I'll bring up briefly later, noted civil rights activists in the late 19th and early 20th century. The first ever woman in space, Sally Ride, grew up Presbyterian. Beverly Cleary, the noted children's author, grew up Presbyterian. Two failed but fascinating presidential candidates, William Jennings Bryan and Norman Thomas. Bryan, the populist, famous for his Cross of Gold speech in 1896. Thomas, a Presbyterian minister turned socialist who ran for president in the early 20th century. Rachel Carson, the environmental activist who wrote Silent Spring, many of you be familiar with her. Business magnates like Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, Andrew Carnegie, one of our Gilded Age kind of captains of industry. You all probably know there have been, in terms of outsized influence, a number of Presbyterian presidents. We won't see if you can name all of them right now. We don't have time for that, but here they are. These are all eight who were sort of definitely Presbyterian. There have been others who were maybe Presbyterian. Abraham Lincoln, worshipped at Presbyterian Church when he did, but didn't officially join the church. Donald Trump grew up Presbyterian and then left the church, I think, around the time that he became president. Thinking about the longer history, you can't tell the history of Presbyterianism in the United States without going back to Europe and to the story of two Johns, one of whom's certainly, probably arguably, sort of most significant figure in the rise of the Reformed tradition, John Calvin. Calvin's one of the central figures in the Protestant Reformation. This is another thing that we spend entire courses talking about. I'm not going to have time to talk about it today. But alongside folks like Martin Luther, Calvin was a key figure, born in France, came under the influence of reformers, Protestants, early in life, converted in his early 20s, and soon fled to Switzerland from France, fleeing persecution. Set up shop eventually in Geneva, where he published the Institutes of Christian Religion. This is part of what established his reputation as a theologian. He was an extraordinarily influential thinker, also quite influential in public life in Geneva. Whereas Luther focused a lot on justification by grace and faith alone, theologically, Calvin emphasized the sovereignty and the glory of God, including, and he became known in part for a doctrine that he had certainly many things to say about. There's much more we could say about it, but the election of the saved, the election of the damned. This was a thing that also became a marker of the Reformed tradition. In terms of worship, the Reformed tradition became known early. It was biblically oriented worship, simple worship, often an emphasis on the singing of the Psalms. These are things that you can still see in our worship up through the present day, though there was not a strict prohibition on other kinds of non-biblical hymns. This is important, ecclesiologically and politically. So in terms of both church and state, the Reformed tradition early on, it didn't fully reject monarchy necessarily, but it embraced more democratic forms of governance, including in the life of the church, where as opposed to the sort of high role of the pope and bishops and whatnot, the Reformed tradition would be more democratic in its approach to church governance. It was also always very interested from the very early on in learning. John Knox is a figure who studied under Calvin, went back to Scotland, and became a key figure in the establishment of Presbyterianism as the main form of church in Scotland in the mid-16th century. There, the Scottish Parliament abolished Roman Catholicism, established Presbyterianism as the official form of church governance. Also, from Europe, we get major creeds and confessions. The Westminster Assembly was called by Parliament in 1643 to reform the Church of England. Its Westminster Confession of Faith from 1647 and short and long catechisms have long been defining statements of Reformed faith. Okay, that was one course right there. By the time of Calvin's death, the Reformed tradition is spreading, and you can sort of see here, so it's this, I don't know what you would call that, teal color that you can see here in Scotland and Central Europe, and it's spreading to the east and to the west. It would arrive in North America by the late 17th century, and it was in colonial Philadelphia that we get the first American presbytery founded in 1706. Part of how I'm going to do this today, and part of how I thought it would make sense to try to capture the complexity and the kind of vast scope of this history, is to think about, in terms of how we got here, what are the things that we've fought about? So I'm going to talk about some of the perennial conflicts in American Presbyterian life that helped to kind of animate some of the action along the way. And one of these conflicts comes up very early, and it's remained. So a lot of these are things that come up at a moment in time and stick with us. Many of these perennial conflicts are also things that are just perennial conflicts in Christianity, but they've played themselves out in one way or another in Presbyterian circles. So one big perennial conflict within American Presbyterian: to what extent is our faith unchanging? to what extent might, or maybe even should, our way of articulating it change over time? So as Presbyterianism is arriving in North America, the Enlightenment is changing the way that people think about religion, think about their faith. And there are lots of folks who are wondering about the kinds of very specific doctrines that are outlined in standards like the Westminster Confession. And wondering, do you have to agree entirely to every single article of something like that in order to be in leadership or to be a part of this church? And from pretty early on, and this has been, Presbyterians have navigated these questions differently. In 1729, there was an early sort of compromise called the Adopting Act, where folks were saying, no, you have to agree to every aspect of the Westminster Confession in order to be considered Presbyterian, met with folks who said, well, I don't know about this one part, and basically said that Westminster was right on all the important stuff, but there might be some wiggle room to figure out what is really necessary and essential in Westminster. What are the things that you absolutely can't disagree with? And maybe there's other stuff that's not quite as significant. So the Adopting Act of 1729 created some wiggle room. And this would be an ongoing dynamic in Presbyterianism in the U.S., where these questions about to what extent you had to hew the line of a kind of traditional confession of faith versus to what extent in the context, and we can see this even today, right, of a world that's changing all the time, of a culture that's putting pressure on the church, where it can seem sometimes, folks would make the argument that, well, we've got to update our faith for the demands of this moment. So that's a conflict that emerges early on. This one may seem strange, but it's been huge in the history of Presbyterian. What should we make of revivalism? I don't know how much you know about revivalism, but it's been a huge feature of American Protestant history writ large. Revivalism, by which we mean kind of this faith of the heart, where people, and this is a kind of defining feature of post-18th century Christianity around the world, where folks were having experiences of God in a kind of intimate way, in a powerful personal way often, and it would play out differently in different contexts. Sometimes they were in churches, sometimes they were in great fields in the colonial period. George Whitefield traversed the whole eastern seaboard and preached up and down in the fields, and folks who went to different kinds of churches came out into the fields and were just transfixed by his preaching because he was such a marvelous orator. And people had these experiences of being sort of convicted of sin and feeling the call of God on their lives and having a sort of new experience of conversion. Revivalism would become a big deal in the colonies. And so pretty early on for Presbyterians, this conflict of what do we make of this thing? And for Presbyterians in particular, and for folks in the Reformed tradition, it raises big theological questions about who's in charge of our salvation, basically. I mean, that's one of the questions at the heart of it is, do humans have any role to play in our own salvation? Is this all through God's sovereign will? And sometimes some of the stuff that happens at revivals where it can feel like there's a human being appealing to the emotion and the soul of another human being, it can feel like maybe those methods don't fit with Reformed faith. Well, I don't know how many of you heard of Gilbert Tennent. He was a New Jersey Presbyterian who in 1740 really set this conflict on fire with a sermon entitled Dangers of an Unconverted Ministry. Tennent was part of the sort of pro-revival camp, the New Side camp, they called themselves. There's a New Side and the Old Side. The New Side liked the revivals that were sweeping across the Atlantic in the mid-18th century. The Old Side was very worried about them. And Gilbert Tennent got up in 1740 and preached this sermon where he accused the Old Side ministry of not being saved, of not being Christian in the first place, and set the denomination on fire. No surprise that next year, the New Side and the Old Side splits. So if you find on your handy-dandy Chutes and Ladders chart there, you can see that split in 1741. It was a short split for 17 years. They were apart. But this fight wasn't over. This question about what to make of revivalism, again, a question that may seem kind of like, why is that important today? But it's a big one. Here's another kind of axis of conflict for Presbyterians through the generations. To what extent is it okay to partner with other Christians with whom we have some disagreements? These are kind of variations on a theme, because the first question about, you know, to what extent does our faith change, or to what extent does it always stay the same, you know, raises these questions about how much latitude is there. The revivalism, right? Revivalism often pushed against, in a way, strict denominational boundaries and crossed them and brought people together in fields or in churches where they were all having an experience of God that didn't seem to run through denominational institutions. So there's ways in which these kind of bleed into each other. But by the time, on the other side of the American Revolution, this question of to what extent is it okay to partner with other Christians with whom we have some disagreements becomes a big one. Part of the story of that period is the massive spread of revivalism. I've said here in this room before that, you know, really we think about sometimes the colonial America as the good old days when everybody went to church, and in reality, almost very, you know, 7% of colonists were members of churches, somewhere in that range. And so it was really after the American Revolution that Christianity grips the nation in a new way, and it's often through these revivals. Part of what we also know is that you get in this period, you know, the United States in that period had a, relatively speaking, weaker state. And a lot of the kind of life of this nascent republic, soon to be democracy, ran through churches. And churches did a lot of the kinds of stuff that Americans needed in terms of reform organizations, in terms of spreading the gospel. There was, you see in the emergence of kind of 1810s, 20s, 30s, of this thing that we call the Benevolent Empire, which is kind of a Protestant thing that is a cross-denominational partnership. It's happening at the same time as these revivals are sweeping the nation. And so people have talked about how in the early republic, you get kind of the fusion of American nationalism and American evangelicalism. And some Presbyterians are a part of this. And in 1801, these Presbyterians who are keen on the revivals that are sweeping and who are very involved in the building out of these new organizations, these new voluntary societies through which kind of emerging democratic life in this country is running. In 1801, they form they call it a plan of union with another church, the Congregationalists, who don't have the same exact kinds of theological ideas. There's a kind of family resemblance. There's a family history there, but they don't have the exact same kinds of commitments. They don't have the exact same kind of church governance. But for a lot of Presbyterians, especially Northern Presbyterians, there seemed to be a lot of good to be had in partnering with these Congregationalists to both build out these voluntary societies and to spread the gospel and to advance the mission of the church. But some folks really thought this was a bad idea. And some folks were really nervous about this partnership with folks who didn't subscribe to the Westminster Confession and who didn't embrace the kind of forms of church governance that many Presbyterians would have seen as the only real biblical way to run a church. So you get lots of conflicts coming out of the revivals. Folks like Charles Finney, who was a Presbyterian pastor, who's a very key figure in what's called the Second Great Awakening. He's sort of creating almost like a social, psychological, a science almost of revivalism. In Kentucky, James McGreedy is a Presbyterian pastor who's part of this phenomenal, it's like the Super Bowl of revivals in the first decade of the 19th century, where thousands of people are coming into the fields in Kentucky and experiencing, having these often very bodily experiences of God. Out of the revivals, you get more conflicts on your sheet there. So you get, you know, out of the revivals, you get Presbyterians who decide to form a new denomination, the Disciples of Christ. They came to believe that through these revivals that God was calling for a restoration of the New Testament church. And so they kind of go off on their own. Out of these revivals, you also get a new form of Presbyterianism, the Cumberland Presbyterians, who had questions about the doctrine of election, this older Reformed doctrine. They also had questions. One of the features of these revivals was, you know, in the colonial period, if you were a minister, you probably had a degree from Harvard or Yale or whatnot. You had an Ivy League degree. After the Revolution, those degrees became more of a mark of shame. In many circles, and really it was folks who, Baptist farmer preachers and Methodist horseback riders and folks who didn't necessarily have formal seminary education that were often driving those revivals. And the Cumberland Presbyterians had questions too about the requirements, the onerous educational requirements that the Presbyterian Church was imposing on its candidates for ministry. So the Cumberland Presbyterians go their own way. By the 1830s, you have a new split. So it's confusing because in the 18th century, you get the new side and the old side. In the 1830s, you get the old school and the new school. And what's at root in this divide? Basically, you have this group of Presbyterians that's partnering with the Congregationalists on spreading the gospel and building out these democratic societies. And you have some Presbyterians who are really not happy about it. They're more doctrinally conservative. They're nervous about the awakenings and the way that the old side was nervous about the awakenings 100 years previously. And they come for the new school Presbyterians, and you get a new kind of fracture in the denomination. That fracture is unfolding at a moment when there is another huge conflict brewing, and this has been another huge axis of conflict that I don't think will surprise you in American Presbyterian life. Questions about when and how do we intervene in public life? And these are questions that obviously remain very much with us into the present day. Arguably, none of them. So, you know, we could trace this in a whole course about war and about economic life and about, but there's no question that the most important and one that would also inflect this new school, old school divide was slavery and the fight over slavery and then an ongoing fight over civil rights. Presbyterians right after the Revolution had condemned slavery in 1787. But gradually, there would be more and more debate and inability to make strong statements as a united body. And again, this old school, new school controversy would partly get slavery, would also inflect that. You can see on this slide here, I've tried to give you like varieties of Presbyterian views on these questions. Henry Highland Garnett was a black Presbyterian minister and abolitionist, fiery abolitionist. Preacher. Elijah Lovejoy was a graduate of Princeton Theological Seminary, is more or less on the outside of Mackay, if you look today, who was also quite rare in being a radical abolitionist white Christian. This was a very rare category, relatively speaking. He was killed in Alton, Illinois in 1837. He ran a printing press, an abolitionist newspaper. And the funny thing about the plaque on the outside of Mackay is that it says he died for the freedom of the press, which he did, but it was an abolitionist press. And it was really because it was an abolitionist newspaper that he was killed. James Thornwell was a Southern Presbyterian who would become a key figure in justifying slavery, and there was an emerging divide within the Presbyterian Church along sectional lines, though not purely sectional lines. We shouldn't romanticize Northern Presbyterians who were not, in fact, all radical abolitionists. Albert Barnes was the pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. He condemned slavery in moral terms, but when you started to dive down into the details, he, like many white Northern Presbyterians, was pretty nervous, in fact, just outright opposed to immediate emancipation of the enslaved for a variety of reasons. Many Northern white Presbyterians, like the folks at Princeton Seminary, you may have heard this story, were much more open to the idea of gradual emancipation and especially to the idea of colonization, which was sort of the idea that slavery was wrong, but also that black people could not be permanent residents, freed black people could not be permanent residents of the United States and needed to be taken back to Africa. There are remarkable examples of black Presbyterians. This is another thing we could do a whole series on. Francis Grimke, another graduate of Princeton Seminary who became a minister in Washington, D.C., and was one of the most outspoken, courageous opponents of lynching during the nadir of Jim Crow in this country. Matthew Anderson, another who was here at the same time as Grimke, graduate of the seminary, went on to Philadelphia and was really involved in civil rights work there. When he came to Princeton, he wrote about this in an autobiography. He was recruited to come to Princeton, and the professor who recruited him believed he was white. And when he showed up, was surprised and didn't want him to live at Alexander Hall, our residence where the students were living at that point. And so it's a long story. Matthew Anderson would write about the challenges, the racism that he experienced at Princeton Seminary, even as it also launched him onto a storied career in civil rights. Ida Wells Barnett didn't grow up Presbyterian, but became a Presbyterian in Chicago amid all of her remarkable work on civil rights nationally. And Dolores Williams, a really key womanist theologian, also a Presbyterian. This fight over slavery, if you look at your chart, would create one of the most deep and enduring divides that the Presbyterian Church ever experienced in this country. The New School, so you have already a split, right, between the New School and the Old School in the 1830s. Then each of those divides again. The New School divides in 1858 into pro and anti-slavery camps, and the Old School divides in 1861. And so now you have four Presbyterian churches that are coming out of these earlier divides about awakenings and revivals and all that kind of stuff. Now slavery has amplified this. We emerge on the other side of the Civil War with those Old School and New School divides that had predated the ones over slavery being patched up. And the churches that emerge on the other side of the Civil War are regional. So you have a Northern Presbyterian church, basically, and a Southern Presbyterian church. I am running out of time. This is crazy. Okay, here we go. We're going to wrap up here in about 7 minutes. So part of the story after the Civil War is you have these now you have a regionally divided, sectionally divided church, and that would be the case until 1983. So that gives you a sense of just how deep and how significant. There was an attempt, if you look on your chart here, in the late 1950s, there was an attempt to reunite these churches, and it didn't take. It was a requirement, I think, for 3/4 of the Southern presbyteries to vote to reunite, and they couldn't get that number. And in fact, in 1983, there was not unanimous desire to reunite, although they did get that 3/4 threshold. So even as this became an enduring divide in American Presbyterianism, a dividing one, the old fights would continue. So you have, in the wake of the Civil War, heresy trials picking up as that first conflict over how much can we adapt our faith. Now you have Darwinism, new ways of reading the Bible coming into being in the wake of the Civil War. And Presbyterians, like all American Protestants, are dividing and debating about, does this mean that we need to update our faith? Does this mean we need to change our faith? And folks are navigating that in all kinds of ways. There's a lot of folks who are attempting to hold together in the midst of some disagreement. But you know that heresy trials culminate by the 1920s in a ferocious debate between fundamentalists and modernists conflict that plays out at Princeton Seminary. I've talked about that here. It's a fun story. J. Gresham Machen arguing famously that liberal Christians were not real Christians. They were wolves in sheep clothing, and that he could not possibly be affiliated with them. This goes back to that other thing about, can we be affiliated? Can we partner with folks with whom we have some disagreements? So these old fights continue. In the early 20th century, I've also talked in this room about the founding of the Federal Council of Churches, this large ecumenical Protestant organization. Folks like Machen are going to see an organization like that as a mess because they don't want to partner across theological difference. But there were conservative Presbyterians who said, no, we want to be a part of that. We want to be a part of the Federal Council. And it's in this ongoing mission of kind of spreading the gospel, reforming society, et cetera. Okay. Who can be ordained and who can serve in church leadership? This is an old conflict. And you know, I've tried in 35 minutes or less to highlight the fact that while the Presbyterian Church has mostly, for most of its history, only empowered white men into institutional leadership, that all along the way there are women, there are Presbyterians of color who are shaping the church and its teachings and its institutions. In the wake of the Second World War, those folks who had been fighting for generations to shape the church and its teachings and its institutions would experience some really significant breakthroughs. In 1956, the PCUSA voted to ordain women, and later that same year, Margaret Towner became the first woman to be ordained in the church by the Northern Church. It would be 8 years later that the Southern Church would ordain the first woman there. In 1964, Edler Hawkins became the first black moderator of the United Presbyterian Church. And then in 1972, Lois Stair became the first woman moderator of a Presbyterian General Assembly. 5 years later, Thelma Adair became the first black woman moderator of the General Assembly. And then in 2011, Scott Anderson became the first gay person to be ordained in the PCUSA. You can look on your chart again and you'll see that all along the way, even as there are these breakthroughs in access to leadership within the denomination, you also have reactions against and new denominations being formed in response to the ordination of women and then the ordination of queer folks within the denomination. As those denominations are peeling off in reaction to some of these breakthroughs, you also have ongoing conflict number four over public life. And we know, we've talked in here before, about the fact that the late 20th century, it became harder and harder to hold together in the midst of great difference. Theologically, the Presbyterian Church in 1967, and this is something I think, Jim, you should talk about at some point, adopts this new confession of faith that was an attempt to hold the church together theologically in a new way, to state our faith anew, its historic meaning, but in the context of the contemporary world. But politically, in the 1960s and 1970s, between civil rights and the Vietnam War, United Farm Workers in California, Presbyterian clergy are often staking out pretty progressive positions on these issues, and yet not progressive enough often for activists and young people who want the churches to go much further. And we talked before about everything from the Black Manifesto to various kinds of calls for more activism and a greater degree of commitment on these issues. Even as at the same time, these leaders who are trying to navigate sort of pressure from grassroots activists and from young folks are finding themselves on shaky ground with often, especially white constituencies on the ground who think that the church has gone off the deep end. And so one of the dynamics and one of the places that we find ourselves in today, right, is reunification in 1983 happens at a moment where the Presbyterianism is also dividing in new ways and is also losing numbers. And that's a very complex story, and it cannot be boiled down. Sometimes you can read online that people try to boil down the sort of numerical decline of Presbyterianism to one thing. Oftentimes you say, they went theologically left and then they lost all the people. And it's actually much more complex than that. So you'll find that explanation, and it's really not a very helpful one in my view. But it is the case that the church found itself under all kinds of crosswinds and cross pressures in the late 20th century, even as also 1965 immigration reform brought in a huge new wave of immigration from Asia, including then thousands, hundreds of thousands of Koreans, many of whom were Presbyterian, and brought a new kind of, continued to sort of diversify the ethnic and racial picture of the denomination. So we sit today at a moment where all this history, right, comes at a moment now where, I teach at Princeton Seminary, and we have young folks coming to study to be ministers, to study, to do all kinds of things. And You can hear in certain corners of Presbyterianism today worries about decline, worries about the falling numbers. I think there's also, I guess, I've said it here before too, that we should be wary of nostalgia for the thing that was. There were some really beautiful things about it, and there were some real problems with it. I often wonder, and we've asked this in here before, and I hope we continue to ask it, and I hope we keep asking it all the way through, what is the new work that God is doing? Even as this other thing seems to be diminishing, what is the new work that God wants to do in our midst? There is stuff in this history, the worlds that we've traveled through, that will be helpful to us all along the way, and there's also stuff to learn. We can learn, too, from the mistakes of those who have gone before us. Okay. 38 minutes. We did pretty well. I'm going to stop there and then invite questions.
Thank you, Dr. Carter, for that 38-minute waltz through 500 years of history. And we have an eager question right over here. We'll bring the microphone over. Well, we're recording for our friends. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Carter. Mm-hmm. So I'm fairly new to the Presbyterian Church, the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I was Episcopalian.
Yeah.
But I want to know, you work with young people probably more so than the people in here, age demographics in here. What are your young students suggesting that the future of the Presbyterian Church look like in your classes?
Yeah.
Because I'd like to hear what young people are thinking, since we're losing a lot of that that age group. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that really wonderful question. I feel like, as I speak to students at the seminary, I don't think any of them or any of us feels like, as individuals, we have the answer to that. I think what's fascinating to me and worth noting is I do think that as I talk to our students, they are interested in the traditions of the church. I don't hear folks who are saying, like, I want to just push all of that away and just start over. I hear a lot of folks who actually, in some ways, some of them grew up evangelical in traditions where maybe they didn't have a sense of a longer history to the things that we believe and to the ways that we do church. So I will say that's one thing I've noticed, is that I do think folks are interested in figuring out what does it mean to have a sense of tradition and bringing a tradition forward, even as, and I think this is a much longer conversation, there's real frustration with churchly institutions and the ways that they work. And that's part of a larger frustration with institutions of all kinds. I often enjoy, I don't think we've figured it out, but I often enjoy those conversations with students about, okay, you're frustrated with the way the church is working. What does it look like to change the church? And I feel like that's where a lot of the action's at right now, is they've got beautiful ideas for how we can more radically, more faithfully live out our convictions. And then figuring out how to bring those convictions to life in the world, I think, is something that we're all trying to figure out together. So I don't know. Lots of conversations. We need to figure out what is it going to be like to be leading faithfully in a society that doesn't revolve around our world. And that's a new thing for Presbyterians, who have always been kind of smallish, but as you saw in those first couple slides, have really exercised extraordinary influence. That influence is in a moment of real challenge. And so what is it going to look like to lead faithfully from maybe the edge in a way that we're not at the center anymore? Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Keith. I always enjoyed your conversation. Yeah. And being myself as a fourth generational Presbyterian from Pakistan and a Presbyterian church historian, a few questions which I pose only one question in two parts.
Sure.
Have you seen any evidence? Because as you mentioned that the early Presbyterians, revivalism played a great role. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons of the conflict with the old and new school was also a foreign mission.
Yeah.
So how do you see that? Is there any link in your observation that shifts on global mission theology in PCUSA impacted the local church mission in USA?
Yeah.
And how that work? Because mission always fuels the church. So have you seen anything because the mission theology decline and it also shifts? So is that was the one of the reason decline of the church in USA, probably?
Yeah, thank you so much for your question. So there's certainly been a shift in the ways that Presbyterians, especially in the kind of PCUSA orbit, think about mission. And this has been a source of conflict in the 20th century, especially around, do we need to have an updated sense of mission? Obviously, in the 20th century, you get new critiques of colonialism and churchly involvement in empire in ways that give Presbyterians in the PCUSA orbit a lot of pause when it comes to foreign missions in particular. And so it becomes a source of conflict. I mean, part of what we know and part of what's interesting in terms of thinking about missions in the 20th century too, though, is we know that, you know, even as Presbyterians were involved in global mission in the 20th century, there's been some really interesting work that suggests that as much as maybe they went abroad with ideas about changing other societies, in fact, they were changed and came back and changed the United States and Christianity here and their children. David Hollinger wrote an excellent book called Protestants Abroad, where he argues basically that the children of missionaries abroad came back home and were often at the forefront of fights for women's rights, for civil rights, that they had learned a kind of missionary cosmopolitanism abroad that came to really deeply inflect. So it's the unintended consequences of missions as well is a big part of that story. We could do a whole thing on missions and Presbyterianism. There'd be a lot to say, both in terms of the conflict over what it is and also in terms of the thinking about its legacies in creative ways.
You've talked about a number of different splits.
Yeah.
And the most recent may be the issue of queer and ordaining queer people.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the effect of that, the consequences of that, and how many churches have decided to go elsewhere?
Yeah.
And have they gone elsewhere to be independent, or have they joined other denominations?
Yeah, yeah. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, though I imagine we could grab them pretty easily. But there has certainly been a significant exodus, just as there was earlier. I mean, the PCA was formed in 1973, I think, after the Southern Presbyterian Church decided to ordain women. And there's a significant exodus at that moment. There's a significant exodus in the aughts and in the lead up to the decision to ordain queer folks. And I do think, you know, a number of those folks stayed Presbyterian in one way or another and forged new denominations. I mean, one of the things that seems to me to be, a sad point of the last, you know, generation as you have these breakthroughs is that the kind of big tent, mainline Presbyterian experience of that earlier 20th century where there were folks, conservative and liberal and everything in between, that were saying, you know, we do disagree about some things, but we should find ways to work together and to live together. This is one of these supreme, you know, this is one of these five axes of conflict. Folks for a long time were able to find ways to do that. And it seems to be, you know, in recent decades, you see kind of the collapse of big tents and the collapse of a willingness to abide with folks with whom we have significant disagreement. And so that's been part of that has siphoned off energy and numbers from and left us more divided as a result. And it is in some ways a perennial tension. To what extent can we partner with folks that with whom we disagree? But we seem to be, in the last generation, less willing to do that. Yeah.
Thank you. Speaking of division,
It
is my understanding that there are two forms of organization. I'm sure there are many, but in general, in the Presbyterian Church. One is the form that Nassau has, which has the session and the moderator at the top of it. The other form, which a good friend of mine belongs to, Brick Church in New York City, has the session, but they also have a board of directors.
Yeah.
And the board of directors decide financial issues and the like, and the moderators decide theological issues.
Yeah.
Is that, you didn't talk about that at all. Has there always been such a divide? Is it a new thing? Is it, what caused it? And what is the primary organization today?
It's a good question. I don't know if any of my friends here want to help me out. This is a Polly question, and this is not my expertise. Carol wants to help me out here.
That's okay. Some churches have both a session and a board of trustees.
Yeah.
And that was common for many years, and I don't know, in my lifetime at least, I think more and more churches went to a combined mm-hmm. session that was also the financial arm.
Yeah.
Didn't separate that out. It's not really a divide. It's just the way a congregation seems to find that it works best.
Yeah.
Especially in large churches, it works well here.
Yeah.
And in some small churches, it's easier to do the board of trustees and the session.
Yep.
But I don't see it as a dividing factor in the denomination.
The one historical, thank you so much for that, Carla. One historical footnote I would add is just that there have long been, and I just don't have time today, but there have been long debates about the particulars of Presbyterian governance, including about the role of elders and whether elders need to be ordained. And these are long-standing debates. But they don't fit into the 35-minute version of the story.
Last question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Carter.
Yeah, of course.
I'm going to ask your question.
Okay.
I think you closed something like, what is the new thing God is calling us to do today?
Yeah.
And I was wondering what some of your thoughts might be in regard to that.
This is where I get to use my, I'm a historian. I look backward, not forward. That's a great question. I mean, I'm really interested in the question. And I've been, one of the most satisfying aspects of being at Princeton Seminary has been the invitation that I feel here to be deeply engaged in that question. And I do feel genuinely that it's a question that requires collective discernment, and that I've learned so much from my friends and colleagues as we talk about that, about what it means for Princeton Seminary, and I love talking with all of you about it as well. I guess what I think is that I believe in the truth of the gospel, and I think there's a lot of value in the Christian tradition, and I hope that we can continue to keep it alive and vibrant in the context of a society that's changing dramatically around us. And I do think, for me, and I do a lot of work on public life in particular, one of the ways that I think about this often is in terms of a deeply polarized society, a society that's deeply, and especially younger folks today, deeply skeptical of institutions. How do we sink deep into the truth of the gospel and bring that out into the world in a joyful, generous way that involves engaging across lines of difference, hanging together with Christians with whom we disagree, finding ways to build bridges to other folks in our society. We live in a deeply pluralistic society. And in a lot of corners, Christianity and pluralism don't seem like they can live together. But I think they can, and I think they should, and I think this churches like this can be a part of figuring out what it means to proclaim a joyful, generous gospel in the midst of a pluralistic society, and I think that's deeply, deeply needed, and so I hope we'll find ways to do that, and I don't know, I think if we can find ways to do that, God will be faithful to multiply the fruits of our labor, and I think that's what I hope for.
Amen. Thank you, Dr. Carter. You did the impossible. You covered.
Thank you.
You covered 500 years of church history.
Thank you very much. I did the best I could.
That was wonderful. And speaking of the present church and the future church, this is a three-part series. In 2 weeks, we'll talk about the future of the PCUSA. And next week, we will have our very own Pastor Dave Davis talking about the present. He is involved in the National Presbyterian Church, PCUSA, and we look forward to hearing it from him and also from Len Scales and Andrew Scales in 2 weeks. And we hope you'll join us. Thank you.